The Bristol Bay Fisheries Report is brought to you by the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association, ensuring long-term growth in the world's greatest salmon fishery through investments in Bristol Bay science, infrastructure, marketing, and quality. The Bristol Bay RSDA, we are on board with you.
This is KDLG's Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. I'm Mike Mason. Today we'll take you back to the December Alaska Board of Fisheries meeting focused on Bristol Bay to hear how several proposed changes to the commercial fishery in the bay were decided. We'll also hear about some new research focused on the king salmon that return each summer to the Nooshigak River. All of that and more is coming up in today's Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. This is KDLG's Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. Back in December, stakeholders in Bristol Bay's commercial, sport, and subsistence fisheries gathered in Naknek for the Alaska Board of Fisheries meeting focused on Bristol Bay. Hundreds of proposals were dealt with, including Proposal 239. It was a board-generated proposal that called for the sport fishery in the Nooshigak River to be limited to using just one single-hook, unbaited, artificial lure during the months of May, June, and July. Among those who testified in opposition to the proposal was lodge owner Brian Kraft.
The intent of this regulation would be to ensure that more kings were made it to spawn, and that there was unintended mortality with catch and release. The biological gain through this, and you can see it illustrated in what I commented on in the written comments, is very small. It's potentially 2,000 kings that would potentially be increased. And there's an economic component to this proposal that, we already battle with the economics of the cost of getting out to the Nooshigak to fish. It's expensive. We had a tough year in 2010, but we're rebounding, and we make it that much harder for people to catch fish. The sport fishing industry could suffer economic consequences.
After quite a bit of discussion, the Alaska Board of Fisheries approved Proposal 239 by a vote of 5-1. However, before approving the proposal, the board changed the proposal by stipulating that the single-hook restriction for the Nooshigak River would apply all year round instead of just during May, June, and July. During public testimony, the Board of Fish heard moving testimony in opposition to eliminating the use of bait in the sport fishery for Nooshigak River kings. Chris Carr operates the Portage Creek General Store and Lodge that serves the sport fishery on the river. He is also a longtime member of the Nooshigak Fish and Game Advisory Committee.
As first written, Proposal 239 would prohibit the use of bait on the Nooshigak king salmon fishery. To do that would put me and my family out of business. The NAC recognizes that eliminating bait will have serious negative economic consequences to the local businesses, from air taxi operators, hotels, grocery stores, storage yards, lodges, boat rentals, fuel distributors, native and non-native landowners, as well as the state of Alaska sports fishing licenses and king salmon stamp sales, all of which generates hundreds of thousands of dollars into a depressed economy. And the lower than expected king salmon returns to the Nooshigak closed the sports fishery in 2010. That, in combination with the national economic slowdown, showed the businesses that depend on the sports fishery a bleak picture of their future if bait is prohibited. Participation declined by half, and many businesses on the river shut their doors. Many of the sports fishermen that come to fish the Nooshigak have stated in no uncertain terms will they return if bait is prohibited. If that occurs, my wife and I will likely go out of business too.
As part of the approved changes to Proposal 239, the Board of Fish changed the wording to allow the use of bait until an angler harvests a daily bag limit of king salmon. At that point, anglers are prohibited from using bait. During the December meeting, the Alaska Board of Fisheries dealt with three proposals that called for one drift net permit holder to be able to own and fish two permits in the bay's massive commercial fishery targeting sockeye. All of the proposals called for that permit holder to be able to fish 200 fathoms of gear instead of the standard 150 fathoms. Among the supporters of the idea was drifter Rex Capri from Newport, Oregon.
I think it fits well with the optimum vessel number study that was done some years ago. And this could be achieved by no additional cost to the state. It would probably turn out that a lot of the same users of dual permits currently in the drift fishery would end up being the two-stack permit. One thing I wanted to point out is there is some opposition to using 200 fathoms with either dual or stack permit, but I think there has to be some incentive to have a second permit, and to really look at it honestly, two permits, whether dual or stack, take out 100 fathoms of gear out of the water, which in essence really increases the earning potential for the remaining single permit holders in the drift fishery.
The idea of allowing one drift net permit holder to own and fish a second permit received no support from the Board of Fish, and proposals 36, 37, and 38 were all rejected. That means that a drifter can still own more than one permit, but they can't actually fish that extra permit, and they can't take advantage of the extra 50 fathoms of gear that comes along with having a second drift net permit holder on the vessel. One of the ideas that comes up every 3 years when the Alaska Board of Fisheries meets to decide Bristol Bay-related issues is to change the current regulation that limits drift net vessels to 32 feet in length. At the December meeting, the board was presented with several proposals to consider to allow for longer vessels. Most of the public testimony was in opposition to the idea. George Wilson, Jr. lives in Naknek.
This fishery out here, the 32-foot boat is adequate to catch the fish that Fish and Game allows us to catch. I don't think that making bigger boats would become safer. As my experiences with other captains is you get a larger vessel, they're still going to fill that boat up. They'll either fish until it's full or fish till it's out of time. So the saying that the quality is going to be better, I have a hard time agreeing with that. I have a small 32-foot boat. It's only 11 foot wide. I put slush ice in it. I can easily handle 10, 11,000 pounds. And I've done a lot of upgrades to this vessel to make it more efficient, but also have a better quality product.
At past meetings, the Board of Fisheries was divided on the idea of allowing longer drift net vessels in the bay, but this time around the idea received very little support and was rejected by a vote of 1-4. Perhaps the most contentious issue taken up by the Board of Fish back in December was related to keeping in place the ability for one set net permit holder to own and fish two permits. Set net stacking, as it's called, was approved by the Board of Fish back in 2009, but with a 3-year sunset clause. That put the issue back before the Board of Fish at the December meeting. Public testimony on the issue was divided. Eric Meyer was representing the Quijac Set Netters Association, which took a position in favor of allowing set net permit stacking to continue.
6 of our 7 board members support these proposals to repeal the sunset clause and allow stacked set net permits. 5 of our 44 members currently have dual permits. Our reasoning is it increases the profitability of a set net operation on any given season, but not necessarily double as the earlier report proposed. Years when limits are in place, low return years, or when fishing within a special harvest area with restricted gear is required, dual permits can help make a season profitable where it may otherwise not be. We feel that there would be no adverse effect in quality. It preserves family operations. For example, when a family member retires, is too young, or has conflicting interests in a particular season.
During the December Board of Fish meeting, the board had 12 proposals in front of them calling for the set net permit stacking sunset provision to be repealed. The board rejected those proposals, resulting in the end of the set net permit stacking system. However, the issue was brought back up again at the Area M meeting in late February and early March, but the result was the same. Another issue that came up at the December Bristol Bay meeting was the idea of allowing fishing outside of the 5 terminal fishing districts. That area is often called the General District. There was very little public testimony in support of the idea and quite a bit of opposition, including from Alegnagic-based commercial fisherman Mark Carty.
Allowing the fleet in a general district should never be allowed. I view that type of fishery as a miniature high seas style of fishing. In a year that would be projected for a particular district not to reach escapement goals, this type of fishing could wipe out that district entirely. Safety would be decreased in a general style type district also. Operating costs could increase as well. In my opinion, general district fishing has no place in Bristol Bay. Do not adopt any proposal allowing general district fishing.
The Alaska Board of Fisheries seemed to agree with Carty because there was no support for opening up the general district. The board voted 0-5 in opposition to Proposal 58 to open the general district for the harvest of up to 25% of the projected sockeye run to Bristol Bay. The board then took no action on the other three similar proposals. Jamie Ross from Homer flew into Naknek to testify to the Board of Fish at the December meeting. He was representing the Alaska Herring Seiners Association. Ross participates in all of the sacro herring fisheries in the state and has been fishing in the Togiak sacro herring fishery for the last 20 years. Ross asserted that the Alaska Herring Seiners Association opposed Proposal 12 put forward by the Togiak Traditional Council. The proposal sought to change the current 70-30 allocation split between the purse seine and gillnet fleets to an even 50-50 split.
I want to stress to this board that the seiners created the modern sacro fishery in Togiak in the mid-70s. Beaver Nelson and some seiners from Homer and Kodiak were the first seiners to successfully pull off a sacro fishery here. The first gillnet allocation took place in 1980. It was changed again up to 25% in, I believe, the early 90s. And at, I believe, three board cycles ago, I took part in an attempt to change the allocation up to 50%. And I took part in a compromise with the gillnetters that we got to the 30% level, and that's where it's been since. So I just hate to go. It was, like I said, an agreed-upon compromise, and I just hate to go down that road again and keep chipping away.
On the other side of the issue was Dillingham-based driftnet fisherman Kenny Wilson. He claims that just 9 of the gillnet herring fishermen are from the Bristol Bay region. Wilson believes that expanding the allocation for the gillnet fleet would allow more local fishermen to participate.
I've been trying to get a market. I've been on the phone since October, and I can't get a market. We have lines of gillnetters trying to get a market for Togiak for herring. We have a few local seiners that want to get back in there. I figure if we work on this now and get this 50-50 split, we'll be set up in at least 3 years. You know, we'll have all our stuff together because we've been sitting on the beach for so long. I think that it's not fair for us to be having the world's biggest herring fishing in our backyard and here we are sitting on a beach. We've been fighting this for years. You know, we've been trying to get on this, this 50-50 split since 1979. Nothing's happened.
Proposal 12 was ultimately rejected unanimously by the Board of Fish, which means that the current 70-30 allocation split between the purse seine gear group and the gillnetters remains in place. The board also unanimously rejected Proposal 13 that sought to shut down the Togiak sacro herring fishery through 2013. You can find a list of all of the proposals taken up by the Board of Fish and how they voted on the Alaska Board of Fisheries website. You're listening to the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report on listener-supported public radio, KDLG.
The Bristol Bay Fisheries Report is made possible in part by AIFMA, the Alaska Independent Fishermen's Marketing Association, 1-800-816-3741.
This is the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. I'm Mike Mason. Imagine if you could harvest a salmon and know exactly where that fish has been and where it's headed. That may sound far-fetched, but the ability to do just that might be here sooner than later. Earlier this year, a PhD student at the University of Alaska's School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences made a presentation in Dillingham about the work he's been doing to try and track salmon migration using the fish's otolith. Sean Brennan says the otolith basically grows much like a tree.
Inner rings, outer rings. The inner rings represent the younger portions of the fish's life, and then the outer rings are the older portions of the fish's life. And I wanted to use that kind of clock, that time, the timekeeping properties of that material in that bone.
Brennan believes that an examination of the material within the otolith can help track the migration pattern of the fish. He chose to focus on king salmon from the Nooshigak River. At the heart of his research is the belief that certain elements in the water can be detected in an otolith, and if the water chemistry of a certain area is mapped, you can determine if a particular fish spent time in that environment. Brennan chose to look for evidence of an element called strontium in the otolith of king salmon captured incidentally in the sockeye fishery in the Nooshigak district.
So strontium is a trace element. There's different types of strontium, and I'm measuring ratios between those different types of strontium. And there's four reasons why strontium is particularly useful for these types of questions. The first of which is that the environment in which the fish is swimming and deriving that material from to make up all of its tissues, that whatever the ratio is, whatever the composition is in that water, in whatever it is going to be identical to the way that you observe it in the otolith. So there's no change. There's no biological differentiation between this type of strontium or that type of strontium. It's just going to take all that strontium, put it into its otolith, and it's going to be exactly the same composition as where it derived. Now it's a pretty good thing you'd want to have in place if you're trying to track environmental information or environmental differences. You'd want the study organism, i.e. the Chinook salmon, to look like where they lived. So that's a very, very important reason why strontium isotopes are particularly useful.
Brennan notes that strontium ends up in the water environment from rocks, and the different kinds of strontium in a particular area is governed by the geology of that area. He says one of the reasons to do his research on Chinook salmon from the Nooshigak River is because of the diverse geology of the region.
So the Nooshigak Hills, the rocks that make up that region are much older, and they're compositionally very different compared to the Alaskan Aleutian Mountains, which are part of the high relief areas, and then also the Aka Mountain province.
As part of his presentation, Brennan showed off a map of the strontium isotopic variations in the Nooshigak River.
And you can see distinct geographic differences. You can see the Alaskan Aleutian Range here is much, much lower, all those blue colors, than the Nooshigak Hills, which are much higher ratios with the orange and the reds. And then you can look along the main stem of the rivers here, these yellows and greens. The main stem is mixing those two end members. So the really high ratios, the really low ratios, and the main stem is mixing that. So this is the baseline information. This is the base of the strontium isotope source. This is where all the fish that live in the Nooshigak are going to get their strontium from. So this is an important starting point.
By mapping the variations in the strontium isotopes in the waters of the Nooshigak River, Brennan is then able to turn his attention to examining the otoliths of Chinook salmon that were collected over the past couple of years in the mapped areas. He admits that it's labor-intensive and slow, but he can actually track the movement of a singular fish by just examining the strontium isotopes.
I have 9 different Chinook stocks with respect to the strontium isotopic composition in their otolith that I can differentiate. I can say, instead of saying, like with the genetics, that the sockeye salmon in the Nooshigak River is all one stock, the strontium isotopes currently, this is preliminary data, say that we can resolve it down to at least 9 different stocks.
Brennan notes that eventually his research could allow fishery managers and others to be able to differentiate where a fish was born within a particular watershed instead of just being able to use the existing genetic signals to pinpoint the watershed. He asserts that one of the next steps in his research is to produce strontium isotopic variation maps for other areas of the state of Alaska.
We're starting to build one that's coming together for the Nooshigak. It's quite high resolution. But this type of effort we'd like to expand to the rest of Alaska. So we're working. We have big sampling campaigns where we've collected water samples, and then we're working with colleagues of Turi and Diego at the University of Utah, who are isotope mappers, and they work on actually predicting what the strontium isotope composition is across Alaska.
Brennan anticipates concluding his research sometime in the spring of next year. At that point, the research will be sent out for peer review. You're listening to the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. You're listening to the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. The Alaska Department of Revenue's released the Alaska Salmon Price Report for last year. It outlines the wholesale values of the different salmon species. The report even breaks that out by region. Not all of the salmon from Alaska are covered by the price report because the reporting threshold for the processors is 1 million pounds of salmon products sold wholesale. The report shows that over 63.3 million pounds of frozen H&G sockeye were sold last year. Over 37.3 million pounds of that sockeye came from Bristol Bay. The wholesale value of last year's statewide frozen H&G sockeye pack was $183.2 million. The value of the Bristol Bay pack was $106.5 million. The average wholesale value of the statewide pack was $2.89 a pound, while the value of the Bristol Bay pack was $2.86 a pound. A look at the fresh H&G product form shows that just over 1.2 million pounds of sockeye from Bristol Bay were sold last year, with a total wholesale value of $4.3 million. The average wholesale value was $3.45 a pound. The report shows that over 8.9 million pounds of frozen fillets from Bristol Bay were sold last year, with a total value of $48.6 million. The average wholesale value was $5.45 a pound. Total amount of salmon roe sold from Bristol Bay last year was reported at over 2.5 million pounds. The wholesale value was $19.7 million based on an average wholesale value of $7.86 a pound. In 2011, over 3.4 million pounds of sockeye roe from Bristol Bay was sold worth just over $20 million. The average price was $5.87 a pound. A look at Chinook salmon shows that nearly 279,000 pounds frozen H&G king salmon were sold out of Bristol Bay last year, with a total wholesale value of over $823,800. The average wholesale value was $2.95 a pound. The report shows that over 1.7 million pounds of frozen H&G chum salmon from Bristol Bay were sold last year. Those chums were worth over $2.5 million, based on an average wholesale value of $1.47 a pound. A look at the data for cans shows that over 167.6 thousand cases of tall cans of sockeye from Bristol Bay were sold last year. They were worth over $32.2 million based on an average wholesale value of $192.60 a case. All of those values were up compared to 2011, when over 126.6 thousand cases of talls were sold. They were worth over $21.5 million based on an average wholesale price of $170 a case. The Alaska Department of Revenue reports that some production areas and production types are not shown in the 2012 price report because of confidentiality requirements. However, they are included in the statewide totals. Statewide total for canned sockeye and halves is over 1 million pounds, worth over $109.5 million. That's based on an average wholesale value of just over $100 a case. All of the salmon caught and sold from Alaska are considered wild salmon, and Alaska is the most dominant player in the production of wild salmon products. That point was noted by renowned fisheries economist Gunnar Knapp during a presentation during this year's session of the Alaska Legislature. Knapp is with the University of Alaska's Institute of Social and Economic Research.
The world's four wild salmon producers are Alaska, Canada, Japan, and Russia. Canada's about a fifth to a sixth to a seventh of Alaska supply, and their production's been declining. So Canada's kind of become a bit player in wild salmon. Russia and Japan both produce about half the volume of Alaska. The Russian production is overwhelmingly pink salmon, and that pink salmon varies enormously from year to year. So you get years when the Russians just catch phenomenal volumes of pink salmon, and to a lesser extent, chum salmon, and much lesser extent, sockeye. So you got this Russian pink that's out there, and it's more pink than Alaska produces, and it fluctuates hugely from year to year. And then you've got Japan, which produces phenomenal amounts of chum salmon, which is entirely from hatcheries in northern Japan. So you've got huge amount of chum from Japan, huge amount of pinks from Russia, and small amounts of the other species.
As far as the wholesale prices for this year's salmon harvest in Alaska, we'll have to wait until about this time next year to get the yearly totals from the Alaska Department of Revenue. You can find the Alaska Salmon Price Report for last year and previous years on the website of the Alaska Department of Revenue. You're listening to KDLG's Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. New research seeks to better understand the micronutrients that are essential for aquatic ecosystems. Salmon are known to be a big source of the nutrients, but scientists are learning that a slightly less delicious organism plays a huge role in the health of salmon-producing streams and lakes. KDLG's Ben Matheson has the story.
The final stage of a salmon's life isn't especially glamorous. After laying eggs, they're exhausted and about done. When they reach their pre-programmed destination, they die, and in a final gift to the world, their bodies decompose and release critical nutrients.
They are like conveyor belts of fertilizers.
Denise Devota is a PhD student at the University of Illinois. She's in Dillingham this summer as part of a multi-year project to better understand the nutrients in the watershed of the Togiak National Wildlife Refuge.
And it's amazing how far these nutrients get into the forests. There are a couple of studies that show that the nitrogen from salmon can be found more than 3 miles into the forest interior from the edge of the stream.
She's paying very close attention to two elements, nitrogen and phosphorus.
Out of all the elements that we have, carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, molybdenum, who knows what, these two are the most limiting amongst any biological organisms we have in the subarctic or in the Arctic up here. It's nitrogen and phosphorus. Those are the two big ones. If we add those two nutrients, life would flourish.
On the banks and hills of the Bristol Bay area are large patches of alder. It's not as romantic as a spawning salmon, but alder's a very big deal in terms of nutrients.
It's so fascinating in southwestern Alaska that 40% of the vegetation cover in this region is comprised of alder, and that is expanding. Satellite images of this region have shown that under climate warming, alder has been expanding northward. It's been creeping up slopes, getting larger and larger and covering more space.
Devota's project aims to measure alder's capacity to contribute those essential nutrients. She's studying 26 streams and 13 lakes.
Off the top of my head, if I can name all of the lakes I'm going to try, we're looking at Gishiak, Good News, Togiak, Little Togiak, Kagadi, Pagadi, Uelik, High Lake, Nagugun, Nenevok, Onlik.
With a great deal of support from the staff at the Togiak Refuge, Devota flies out to lakes and streams. She measures water depth and velocity twice a year. She collects a few liters of water and drops in sediment traps. Those go back to Illinois to be analyzed in the lab. She can tell to some degree which nutrients come from fish and which from alder based on a few different isotopes and statistical models.
We are seeing that in our streams, alder is a major contributor of nitrogen. So that's really exciting. For our lakes, that's where the story gets even more complex and exciting, because lakes are more complex. They bring in nutrients from all across the watershed. They integrate that and bring that to one spot. And we're seeing that in the lakes, salmon and alder, both of them are contributing to not only more nitrogen and phosphorus, but more life as well. And what I mean by more life is that we're seeing more algae, more zooplankton, which are little critters, that they're like insects in the water that baby salmon feed on and other fish feed on. So that's pretty exciting. I need to say clearly that these are all preliminary results, but these are some of the relationships that we're seeing so far.
Everything is still preliminary, but Devota says the study has potential implications to future salmon management.
And what this study aims to do is it wants to answer the question of, if we have alder in the watershed that we know is a fertilizer, do we still need as many salmon escaping upstream? Can we reduce that number because alder is contributing nutrients to the lakes and the streams? And given that alder is set to expand in area, this is going to be a critical question to answer.
You can view photos of DeVota's fieldwork at kdlg.org. In Dillingham, I'm Ben Matheson.
That concludes this edition of the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. The report can be heard each Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at straight up 4 p.m. during the months of June and July. If you have something to add to the report, please send me an email to mike@kdlg.org. You can also call 842-5281. This weekend's Bristol Bay Fisheries Reports are the final reports of the season. I would like to thank KDLG reporters Dave Binninger and Ben Matheson for all their help this summer in putting together the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reports. The reports can be found online at kdlg.org. Until next season, please be safe, keep an eye on the weather, and stay tuned to Bristol Bay's public radio station, KDLG.
The Bristol Bay Fisheries Report is brought to you by the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association, ensuring long-term growth in the world's greatest salmon fishery through investments in Bristol Bay science, infrastructure, marketing, and quality. The Bristol Bay RSDA. We are on board with you.